Accession number 18537, Reel 1.
This is an interview with Lieutenant Colonel Ian Nielsen, recorded by Rodney Giesler in Marlborough, Wiltshire, on the 12th of August 1998 for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive.
Tell me a bit about your origins. When were you born and what was your family life?
Well, I was born in 4th December 1918. My father was a solicitor in Glasgow, and he started life as an apprentice mining engineer in Denver, Colorado, where grandfather was. He was in some form of textile activity back in the 1880s, and it wasn't going awfully well, so they came back to Scotland. My father was told he'd jolly well got to do law, which he did very successfully, because he got the Scots Law Prize at Glasgow University in 1900, which was quite something, I think. And I was at school in Glasgow, at Glasgow Academy, as was my younger brother, who was a metallurgical boffin. I did law there, and also forensic medicine, which was surprisingly useful 10 years later when I was running the war crime investigation unit in Germany. That was a surprising twist of fortune. And I was a territorial in Royal Artillery before the war in Glasgow. And in moments when I wasn't playing rugby, one enjoyed the TA activities very much indeed.
Now, those TA activities, what unit were you in at the time?
The 57th Glasgow Searchlight Regiment, which of course is a place for older men. And I got out of that in December 1939 and did a gunnery course at Llanrhyndod Wells in Wales, which was a much more interesting exercise. And after that, I went to the 127th Highland Field Regiment, largely the result of the students' rugby team having demolished the instructors' rugby team. we enjoyed that hugely.
Sorry, where was the rugby team? At Llanrhyndod Wells?
Llanrhyndod Wells. And we had a very good mix in the field regiment, because although it was stationed in the county of Angus near Forfar, there were three batteries, Arbroath and Dundee and Forfar, and the chaps were a convivial lot altogether. And being a newly joined second lieutenant at that stage, I went on various courses, one of which was air cooperation. This was at Lark Hill on Salisbury Plain, the same night and down where operationally we were trained for AOP eventually. And this course was, of course, related to work with Lysanders. Absolute dead loss, because the pilots flew in circles round the target, I got frightfully cross, because I was taken up one morning at 8 o'clock without any protective clothing. I got cold, I got sick, and was very angry indeed at the fact that I'd come to grief on that. And I determined that if there was any flying to be done in the future, I'd jolly well do it myself. And very shortly after that, there was an opportunity to apply for AOP, and I did that in May 1940, just at the time, in fact, when the Germans were breaking through and Dunkirk and everything was apparently pretty grim.
Your previous course, then, was concerned in learning the ground-based end of AOP, was it?
The previous course, no, was concerned in dealing with the ground end of what was army cooperation. In other words, gunnery by Morse from the aircraft and the use of a certain amount of ground signals and a thoroughly distant process. There was no close contact at all. One never met the pilots. One never saw the pilots who were from, in fact, Old Sarum. It was all remote, ineffective, and there was no quick response, there was no proper briefing. And by briefing, I mean from ground to air and air to ground, which we had in AOP. So having applied for AOP and having had a medical in September, I then went to Woodley at Reading, number 8 EFTS, which was the Miles Factories airfield, in beginning of November 1940. And there were six of us at that stage, and we came from various different gunner units. We were mainly field, but there were two chaps from a medium regiment. And
sorry, can you just differentiate between field and medium?
Yes, the field gunners, of course, were originally 18-pounders, then 25-pounders, and the medium were probably 5.5 guns, or in some cases 4.5.
They were less mobile, presumably.
Yes, and capable, of course, of much heavier firepower. And one found those in Army Groups RA, of which more later.
Yes.
And so the flying course was just the normal RAF process, really. Our instructors were a bit sort of taken aback at this army intrusion, because our emphasis, of course, was on low flying and precautionary landings, you know, the creeper approach and the use very much of a large field near Thiel to the west of Reading. A field, I think I pass it in the train every time I go up to town, and
it's still a field, isn't it?
It's still a field, a large field, and still capable of, I'm sure, receiving aircraft. And the flying course was fun, in spite of the aircraft, which, of course, was the Miles Magister, a beastly aircraft, really, because it had no cockpit cover. It was drafty. It was not very well powered. I mean, the Gypsy Major engine. It had no flaps. It had no sort of, I'm going to say, ease of control. It was inclined to have a vicious spin, and stalled pretty suddenly if it got the chance, but it didn't. And then, having done the course, we were returned to our gunner units, all six of us, because there were no AOP aircraft available. And by this time, of course, very early spring, 1941. So, having had 2.5-3 months with our units, we went back. I went back to Aberdeenshire, and it was still virtually winter, more or less. But I didn't succeed in doing what I was trying to, which was to borrow the Miles Magister, which belonged to the station commander at Dyce. He was remarkably diffident about letting an army lieutenant.
How many hours did you have to your credit at that time?
About 50 plus. It was very, very sketchy, really. It was very thin on the ground. And I think he was quite right. So we were called, anyway, in May 1941 to D flight, which was on Knight and Down at the west end of the Royal School of Artillery at Lark Hill, and was an area of downland which sloped downwards to the west, and on which was inclined in warmer weather to float. You got really to make sure you did a short landing. But Knight and Down was a satisfactory time. We did an enormous amount of low flying, really low flying, a lot of gunnery, miniature range practice, live shooting, very little radio work, really, and a lot of map reading, particularly low level. So we got to know the Wiltshire countryside really very well indeed.
How did you communicate with the gunners? Were the Morse key still?
No, it was entirely voice radio. The army, 21 sets, 11 sets. I think on one occasion, I can remember, I had a 9, but it was normally the 11 and the 21, and then I think the 22. But I really find difficulty in being accurate on that one.
I still had them when I was in the signals 10 years later.
Yes. And having got to August 1941, we were all five of us, because the sixth member had departed by that stage, back to his regiment. We went to Old Sarum to form 651 Squadron with another 12 earlier gunner officers who were all on courses 1 and 2. We were number 3 course.
What were you flying by this time?
Well, we had Piper Cubs, we had Auster 1s, really the Taylor craft.
The Taylor craft ones, yeah.
And it was the Auster 1, grossly underpowered, no flaps, a 90 horsepower, Cirrus Minor, I think, engine, a very easily handled aircraft, but not good for taking off from small fields, and not easy to land, really very short. So we had the 1, and we moved B flight 651 from Old Sarum in the early autumn to Thornford, west of Sherborne in Dorset, between there and Yeovil. And we lived in considerable comfort in the local village pub, which is still there, King's Arms. And the men in the flight, of course, were 50% Army, 50% RAF, were in the farm buildings across the road. And our landing ground consisted of two small fields knocked into one just beyond the farm buildings. A very small field into which our squadron CO had considerable difficulty landing. They used to come and visit us by road. But it was a very hectic time, because our job then really was to sell the AOP to gunner regiments wherever we found them. And that was a very interesting and very useful exercise, because where possible we took the aircraft with us. And we went around the country, and for convenience sake we decided to move down near Wimborne in Dorset, and I had the job of finding a suitable place for us to live. Well, fortunately, Charborough Park, the home of the Drax family, Admiral Sir Reginald Plunkett, only Earl Drax, was available. And they allowed us to live in one wing of this, and all the farm buildings, I'm sorry, not farm buildings, the stable buildings, just up the road, a few hundred yards away, were available for the men to live in. And of course, there were lots of trees in the park under which the aircraft could be suitably placed and hidden. And we operated from there as busily as possible. We went to work, for example, in Wales, at Sennybridge, with various regiments shooting on the Brecon Beacons, and that was also a good experience.
At that time, were there any AOP units actually in theatres of war overseas?
No, no. Later in 1941, 651 Squadron went to North Africa. 1942, sorry.
42, yes.
42, because...
After Torch.
Yes, they were involved in that in the early stages and had a fairly hairy time. They did some jolly good work, but limitations of the aircraft and weather conditions and so on had a marked effect. They had a very difficult time. In August 42, 652 Squadron was formed and became the development unit. I commanded B flight in that squadron from 42 to 44, and we had a very interesting time because we concentrated on communication work, the radio work, in spite of these beastly sets that we had, really worked surprisingly well with the many units that we operated with. We did our carrier training, aircraft carrier training, two lots. We had a lot of shooting with the Navy. That was developed, that was done on, of course, a clock code basis, a different procedure from the Royal Artillery. And we did some night flying, not very successfully, because night flying in Northwest Europe is an absolute waste of time because of the night haze. And we got quite good at map reading. We also did a lot of aerial photography, low-level oblique photography. That was developed primarily by a chap who latterly became a chartered surveyor called Hugh Orr, who lived in Bristol, and did a very useful job indeed.
Were these with handheld cameras, or were they mounted in the fuselage?
They were mounted in the fuselage, and I think latter experience showed that it was a bit tricky sometimes because one had to, because of the need to fly straight and level, which is not the normal AOP process, very unwise, in fact. But a lot of AOP photography done, and the Museum of Army Flying at Middle Wallop has got a lot of those oblique photographs.
Now, these were presumably at the speeds you flew. Did you do multi-overlap photography, or just on certain targets, single frames?
They were not multi-overlap. They were, I can't for the life of me remember what the camera settings were, but it was...
specific targets, presumably, that you were sent up to.
Yes, well, particular areas, really, forward areas, and one could see places where hostile batteries might well be, and that was a great help, of course, in the counter-battery work that we did, and indeed in the... registration for harassing fire and general future use worked very well.
Now, you mentioned the differing nature of the Army and Navy.
Yes.
Way of marking targets.
Yes.
Could you explain that in a bit more detail?
Yes. Well, as far as the Army was concerned, the procedure was quite straightforward. in that one hoped to be able to give fire orders before taking off, the initial fire orders, such as the target map reference and probably a target number and the type of ammunition you wanted and anything sort of relevant, and then take off and hope that the guns were reporting ready at that stage. And then at the appropriate moment, the order to fire, one knew the time of flight, and that was very important because as the shell was on its way, so the pilot would be climbing up to the appropriate height for observing, depending what the target was. I mean, the normal height of chutes was 500 to 1,000 feet somewhere. If one had occasion sometimes to fire on very much longer ranges, you might well be up in the sort of over 2,000 feet, just depended on the weather and what the target was.
Obviously above the trajectory peak of the...
No, usually the shell itself would... I mean, 4T squared, four times the time of flight squared, would be the height of the target, of the shell, on its way to the target. And so one had occasionally, I certainly remember one occasion I saw a medium shell, a 5.5 round, which probably weighed about 100 pounds, passing under my left wing on its way to the target. So that was interesting. But
so, I mean, what was the time of flight then, typically? I mean, how fast did shells travel?
Well,
100 miles an hour? Or?
No, I don't know how many feet a second they did, but the time of flight would probably be anything 25, 30, 40 seconds.
Long as that?
Yes, depending what the range was and what one was doing.
So when you reported the fall of a particular shell, you had to identify it and when it went down the barrel, presumably.
Well, they would say ready. You would say fire.
Oh, you'd actually tell them to fire.
Oh, yes, certainly, because, you see, you might well be in the wrong direction. You might well be in the wrong place to do the actual observing. So you've got to get to a point climbing like mad so that you could observe the fall of shot. And the great art was to be able to have the aircraft facing roughly in the right direction when the shell was about to land. And very often I found latterly that I was observing the fall of shot through the roof of the aircraft. Or,
well, as you were turning.
Yes, yeah. Just depending, because one wasn't going to be flying straight and level for more than just a very few seconds. There's no future in that.
And so you were plotting these the targets and the fall of shot.
Well, you'd observe the fall of shot, yes. And you'd then give a correction, which would be more or less, or add 400 or drop 400, whatever it might be. So the target, by that process, was bracketed. And when the targets have been suitably bracketed, you go for fire for effect. So many rounds gunfire. And depending whether it was a counter-battery thing or...
When you say fire for effect, I mean dropping shot within those limits that you've defined.
Yes. In other words, that your fire for effect, depending how good the guns were, would all be sort of in roughly the same sort of area. And if you were firing at a hostile battery, then the chances were that that would be effective because their guns would be spaced out in roughly the same way as one's own, probably. And depending, of course, how many guns you were actually shooting, because you would probably be doing the initial ranging with a troop of four guns, and you might well be going to fire for effect with a whole regiment of 24 guns.
These would be 5.5s, would they? The big ones?
No, those would be 25 pounders, probably, because the medium guns were mainly in, I'm going to say, a supporting role. You see, the normal arrangement was that you had a brigade and you had a field regiment with that brigade. And behind that, in support, you'd have probably an army group RA, which might be two or three medium regiments. It might be a heavy ACAC regiment in a ground role with 4.5 gun, or 4.7s, I think they were mostly. And, of course, the more guns, the merrier. And very often, fire for effect under those conditions didn't need adjustment. You just called for so many more rounds, fire for effect. As far as shooting with the Navy was concerned, we were always, of course, delighted to be shooting with the Navy because they were so accurate. And as long as...
On a sea target or on shore target?
Oh, on shore targets, yes, because we didn't do any shooting against sea, hostile ship targets. That was their prerogative. But the arrangement with the Navy was that on the bombarding ships, there would be a bombardment liaison officer, a BLO, and probably a telegraphist party who were probably Navy. And our fire orders went to the BLO on the bombarding ship, and their firing was corrected by means of a clock code with 12 o'clock north. And so you had to visualize, depending what the target was, where it was, where your 12 o'clock north, 6 o'clock line ran, and concentric circles of 100 yards, A, B, C, D, E, and give corrections accordingly. And your corrections there were in fact observations of where the shot was, so that you might well have Charlie 7 to begin with, and they would then correct the thing, and the chances are it would be very close, probably, and you would not require very many corrections. And we'd done a lot of preparatory bombardment work with the Navy, a lot with small caliber guns, with, for example, destroyers, bombarding cruisers like Belfast, Diadem, so on, and I'd even bombarded the Mull of Kintyre with great satisfaction with HMS Rodney, which was at the time off the north end of the Isle of Arran and the Clyde.
When you say bombarded the Mull of Kintyre, I mean, what kind of targets were used then?
Oh, just a patch of moorland, from which the sheep had been cleared.
And they planted their huge shells.
Oh, yes.
Into the
yes, I mean, this enormous weight of shell, highly effective. And the naval gunnery really was quite first class. And I'm happy to have association now with the Bombardment Units Association, because I'm a sort of honorary member of it, which is quite fun.
So really, going back to my original question about the differentiation, the Army used a grid reference system.
That's right.
That we all use on ordnance.
Indeed, indeed.
And the Navy used this clock.
Yes.
In concentric circles, because obviously the Navy didn't steer by grid references, except in the much broader
quite.
Term.
Yes.
I understand that completely. Yeah.
And it was very interesting that in Normandy, we found that there was an error of about 200 metres or so in the maps, so that you had to be rather careful, in other words, not expecting the shell that you had asked for to be coming up quite in the right place initially. But it worked very well, and we did a lot of shooting. There were troop targets, there were regimental targets, which were mic targets, there were group targets, uncle targets, and there was even a corps target on occasions with several hundred guns, which was a Victor target.